Coming up on the Sarlacc Pit podcast, publicist and podcaster Kinsetta Parker joins us to discuss Rancho Obi-Wan's induction into the Guinness Book of World Records. We also talk J.J. Abrams and some recent rumors in the Star Wars saga. We talk about the new Star Wars comic that hit newsstands, Vader and Tarkin, in this week's Things That Make You Go Hmm. And we also give you some of our underappreciated contributors to the Star Wars saga. All that and more coming up in this episode of the Sarlacc Pit podcast. It's a good one, and it starts right now.
We just got to the Sarlacc Pit.
And the powerful Pleiades.
The almighty Sarlacc.
Binds the galaxy together.
All-powerful Sarlacc.
Its energy surrounds us and binds us.
Welcome to the Sarlacc Pit, official podcast of GalacticBinder.com and Yodasnews.com, the fans podcast. So grab your lightsabers and join your hosts, Matt Krenke and Chris Hoffice Planet, for this round of discussions.
Welcome, Star Wars fans, to the Sarlacc Pit podcast. The Sarlacc Pit podcast is brought to you by GalacticBinder.com and Yodasnews.com, and we thank them for their support of the podcast. This is episode 68 for September 13th. Oh, it's Friday the 13th, 2013. My name is Matt, your co-host for the show, and joining me on the other side of the podcast, Mike, your creator and co-host, Chris Hoffice Planet Smith. What's up, my friend? How you doing?
What's going on? Not much. I just realized it was Friday the 13th as well.
I know.
We got probably some scary things.
Are we gonna have bad karma today? I hope not. Hey, we got a great show today, Chris. We're going to be talking J.J. Abrams, the new Star Wars comic, the underrated contributors to the Star Wars saga in our main topic section. But before we do that, let me introduce our guest today. She's a publicist, a podcaster, collector, and most of all, a huge Star Wars fan. Kinsetta Parker is in the pit. Kinsetta, thank you for taking a few minutes for us today. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And it's Friday the 13th. I love Friday the 13th. So many people focus on the negative of it. I believe that means there's more good juju out there. So it'll be a good day. Yes.
Yeah. Everybody break out your Friday the 13th movies, part 1 through 20 or whatever they have today, and have a little marathon. Kinsetta, we got you on today. There was some big news that hit over the last few days, and Rancho Obi-Wan has been inducted into the Guinness Book of World Records for 2014. Some big news. And let's just, before we get into that, I want to play a quick clip of the man behind Rancho Obi-Wan, Steve Sansweet, talking about his induction.
The inventory is now up to about 91,000 pieces, but based on what we know we have, we think that that is probably less than one third. So about 300,000 individual pieces, and that's a lot. I've known about the Guinness World Records book almost from the start, and I always look in the index to see if there's anything on Star Wars, and there frequently is. And I think it's a wonderful tribute to what I've been able to put together with the help of so many people around the world.
So there you go. That's Steve talking about his induction. And what a cool thing. And I've always wondered, you know, and some of us have wondered, you know, does he have the largest collection? And it's been confirmed now. And I was just so impressed about, Chris, I mean, 300,000 pieces over. I mean, I fight for, you know, the 200 pieces I have with my wife in the house here. I mean, it's just incredible, the amount of stuff. And Kinsetta, I want to ask you, I know you were there for a lot of this. Can you kind of go over what happened, what transpired?
Oh, it's been a crazy, awesome journey. This actually, we have been sitting on this news since last October. Oh. So it's been, you know, working with Guinness World Records has, I can't even begin to explain how incredibly interesting, fascinating, stressful, difficult it's been, because they actually contacted us. which it's one of those, I got the email and at first, you know, you get emails all the time. And you're like, is this for real? Is this really Guinness World Records contacting us? And I called Steve and Anne and I was like, so I got an interesting email and I think this is for real. Let's look into it. And that's kind of how it all started last, I believe, oh gosh, I think it was July that they'd reached out to us. So we set it up and all the photos in that you see and that's featured in the Guinness World Record book, we actually did that photo shoot in October last year.
Wow, okay.
And it's one of those, you know, you hear about Guinness World Records and you see all the crazy things and, you know, I had no idea what was going to be entailed. And I can tell everybody the documentation that they required, you know, you'd think, oh, you're just going to walk in and go, oh yeah, you guys got the record. You can just look around, even just pictures, but they physically came. We had to prove the documentation, everything that had been cataloged, the estimations, all the calculations. I actually have bet Steve that I think 300,000 as a guess is way below what we really have. I bet money we're closer to 500,000. But I mean, what we had documented at the time was over 90,000. Now we're actually closer to having 94,000 things documented. But what was really cool is that the editor in chief of Guinness World Records, Craig Glenday, he personally came to our photo shoot and for the documentation because he's a huge Star Wars fan. He came, we all totally just geeked out looking, you know, we gave him the tour and he was one of us. He was a fan, really enjoying it. And he actually canceled several other trips he was supposed to take so that he could personally come to Rancho Obi-Wan and experience it. And we've got great pictures of him playing with a lot of the toys. He put the Greedo mask on. Everybody has to pick up a Han Solo blaster and, you know, and try it. But for lack of a better way to say it, truly a galactic experience going through all this, getting to this point, being so proud to be able to say, it's official. We did it. You know, we are the largest, and the outpouring of support from fans all over the world since the news broke has, like, I just get chills every time I see more and more things, you know, the congratulations and the excitement, and 'cause that's what Star Wars is all about. It makes us happy and we enjoy it. And now, you know, hopefully this will help more and more people know that there is a place that you can come, you know, to Rancho Obi-Wan and experience that, you know, and just love it and be happy and not worry about what anybody else thinks or says. Everybody's welcome.
You know, I think that this will be a good little boost to y'all's beefing up your tours and stuff from this news alone, because I mean, I've been looking at it, I've been sharing the pictures over to our Classic Star Wars page, and I've noticed that just how much more activity you had just on your Facebook page alone from this. So,
oh yeah. And Twitter just blew up, which was awesome. And it's what's really fun. Like, last night, Craig Ferguson on the Late Late Show,
I heard this
in his opening monologue. It's awesome. I mean, you know, he's snarky and he's spoofing it, and it's all in good fun. And he talks about the Guinness World Records, and of all the ones that he chose to talk about, he talks about Steve. He's like, hey, you know, there's this Steve Sansweet, and they show a picture of Steve, and an old picture of him, but, you know, but in the museum. And I just cheered. It's just so awesome. I was like, we made the Late Late Show, and it was featured in TV in Scotland and, like, in Tokyo. And like I said, the editor-in-chief, Craig Glenday of Guinness, he has done interviews on his top five favorite records for this book, and we're one of them. And wow. It's just, it's so fabulous. But I mean, it's been constant communication between me and Steve and Anne. It's like, oh my gosh, did you see this? Oh my gosh, did you see this? This is so great. So it's overwhelming and it's exhausting, but in the best possible way. I mean, I'm in for breaking the record on caffeine and sugar consumed in the past 72 hours, because we have not, we have not slept, really. I apologize if I sound like I've been at a Metallica concert screaming, but I've like, my voice is going,
Yeah.
I'm all jacked up on caffeine.
Yeah, jacked up on caffeine. You know, I heard about that Craig Ferguson thing. I was like, yeah, that's, I mean, you know, this is Star Wars. I mean, everything of Star Wars gets in the news somehow or another, and this is really cool. I want to ask you about the documented thing. You know, Steve talked about 90-some-odd thousand documented, but it's up to, like you said, maybe up to 500,000. What, I mean, are you just documenting like really big things, or how does it?
No.
Why is there such a big difference?
Everything. So, I mean, you can look at a picture like the picture that's featured in the book, and you go, okay, there's a bazillion things there, and we have a lot of things on display, but not everything is actually cataloged. So right now we currently have like in our database where Ann Newman, our like my dearest friend and the manager of Rancho, she, because everything is in is grouped, you know, into different areas, whether it's action figures or, you know, magazines, books, and she catalogs everything. Everything goes in, the date, the source, the country, what is it, you know, which edition. And that, as you can imagine, is incredibly time consuming. She actually came to Rancho about 8 years ago, and they thought maybe it would take 6 months for her to document everything. That was 8 years ago.
Wow.
And being there on days when things are cataloged, it is so tedious because you want to make, you know, you want the correct information. You've got to make sure all the facts are right. So right now, about 94 things are actually cataloged in the inventory. And we, Steve thinks that we actually have about 300,000 things. And Ann and I have both said, you know, there's got to be more than that. When you think about all of the, I mean, just look at the magazines and the books and, you know, there's, we've got like, you think about all the collector cards and all those individual pieces from all over the world over, you know, 30 plus years. I can't wait till we actually get to that point where we're never going to be caught up cataloging because there's new things coming in all the time.
Right.
But I can't wait to see, you know, 5 years from now what that number is really going to be.
Yeah.
You know, because I told him, I said, look at the picture when you just of the front bay of the museum looking in, even the picture that's featured in the Guinness book. I'm like, to me, that looks like there's over 300,000 items right there.
Right.
And I know what we went through to set up that photo shoot. It was insane because you think, oh, well, they'll just have them stand in front of the museum and we'll take the picture. No. They knew exactly what they were looking for, and they were so awesome. They wanted to fill every gap around Steve to really showcase all these different items and show the variety. And they didn't want any empty space to be seen on the floor or anywhere around him. So for, I don't know, 3-4 hours, we just kept pulling things off of the shelf. And you can't even tell. I was like, we pulled probably 400 items off the shelves behind, and you can't even tell. But it was, you know, somebody grabbed something that's medium and green. So I'd run for a Yoda, and another volunteer would run for something that's Greedo. And we just positioning it for the best possible picture to really showcase the awesome collection that Steve has at Rancho Obi-Wan. It was so much fun. But then, of course, it was, oh, now we got to put all this stuff back.
Oh, jeez.
It was an insane, awesome day. But it was, and we didn't know actually until after. It was like, so when can we talk about this? Oh, next September. I was like, no, we can't say anything. And it was a very strict embargo that anybody that's a record holder, you cannot say a word.
Ah,
and we had been told, given the date of September 12th, you know, months ago. So we had been preparing for the big launch and announcement on September 12th and preparing for it, getting ready for it. And the communication coming in kept changing, and no, it might be this and it's that. And we weren't really sure. And then news broke Wednesday evening of September 11th. And that's when we went ahead and put out our, you know, I called Guinness and I was like, word is out. And they're like, go for it. You can, you know, go ahead and let everybody know. So that's why we went ahead and made our big announcement that night.
So now to have the record, what exactly is his record that he, is there a certain number? Like, I don't think it's a number, right? It's or is it a number?
There was a previous record from years ago for the largest Star Wars collection. And we, with our cataloged 90,000, we beat that record by at least three times, I believe.
Okay.
And we didn't, it's one of those things, you know, and Steve and I had talked about it, and Anne, he said, you know, I've had Rancho Obi-Wan a long time, but it was never an ego thing to say, hey, we've got the largest thing. But when we incorporated Rancho Obi-Wan as a nonprofit, you know, to make sure that it's going to be there for generations to come to experience it and have all that there as the cultural phenomenon that it is, you know, he said, I do think when they approached us, that was the big reason why it's like, you know what, let's do it. You know, get the word out about it and let people know that they can come and experience and enjoy it and become a member and help contribute and be a part of keeping Star Wars alive and available for years to come. And yeah, so it's just, insane.
Yeah, I'm just excited. I mean, me and Chris and some other guys were planning on coming down there this September, right, Chris? And some things fell through.
Yeah.
But we're definitely looking forward to getting down there. We wanted to have a whole podcast down there, a video podcast. We've been planning that. And we're really excited, you know, even now more than ever. Just the fact, like you said, he opens it up and you're allowed to come in and just check out all this stuff. And for anybody out there who wants to try to beat Steve's record, there you go. You got your numbers right there. So get on it, Chris. Get on it.
Yeah.
And we change all the time. I was interested when I people that had come before, and then I would get emails from members saying, you know, I was there 6 months ago, and has anything changed? Would it be worth coming back? And it's like, absolutely. I mean, I'm there all the time, and there's always something new, and I get just as excited every time because it's so overwhelming on such a grand scale of happiness. And there's, you know, we change the collection around, and because there's items that are always in storage, obviously there's no way to have everything displayed. So we move things around. So there's always something new to see and experience, and new items come in all the time. It's interesting. Yeah. I really started to think about people wondering about that. It's for Celebration Europe when we were packing up to send the Rancho Obi-Wan experience to Germany. Suddenly people were like, oh, well, I'll wait then to come to book a tour because everything will be gone. It's like, oh, no. you couldn't even tell that anything was off the shelves because, you know, we remove, what, like 300 items. Well, that's nothing. But then that enables us to bring 300 other things out of storage to rotate around. And now we're preparing because we just got word that the shipment from Germany is on its way back and should be arriving, I believe, Monday or Tuesday. We found out. So it's like, okay, we got to get ready. The big truck's coming back to put everything.
You got to move everything back in. Wow. It still hasn't come back from Germany yet. Wow.
Yeah.
I'd be a little nervous about that.
We've been super nervous about that with no word. It was like, where is it? Is it still on the boat? Is it in the country? Where is it?
Yeah.
And that was something that was super stressful in planning to send it over because we knew we had to the containers and everything that would be they'd be on a ship in the ocean heading to Germany and trying to determine what to package and what, you know, because they say it's like, what would you be willing to lose in case something happened and it doesn't come back? And that's it. That's it's like,
nothing.
Hey, next time you have to ship anything, why don't you let me know? I'll have me and some of my SWAT friends will come down, and we'll help get that package to where it needs to go. Okay?
Oh yeah. It's interesting. We have a really long list of people that have made that offer.
Really?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh shoot, Chris. Anything more before we let?
Yes, I actually have one question, and I don't know quite how to necessarily ask this, but since Rancho Obi-Wan is nonprofit, do y'all have any employees at all? And anybody that, say, lives close to there, can they volunteer to come in and, say, help with the calculations and all that, cataloging, I should say, or anything of that nature?
Oh, we have a huge volunteer base of wonderful people, actually all over the world. So, I mean, if you are going to plan a trip and you want to come to Rancho Obi-Wan and you're setting it up, and you can, when you're setting that up, you can, you know, say, I'm happy to help. Is there anything going on during the dates? Because we do, you know, pick certain dates where we have a massive volunteer gathering where we, especially when we have big projects that need to be done. In fact, this past weekend, we had 10 volunteers come out and help with some demolition on a part of the roof on the back barn. And so it's a lot of physical labor at Rancho Obi-Wan, because so many of the items, especially when we move boxes, mm-hmm. it's like playing Tetris with 50-pound boxes, because you're just constantly moving things around. We calculated, oh gosh, that I personally have probably moved 25,000 pounds of magazines alone. So, and I mean, and even just dusting, I'm like, we need to have a massive Swiffer party and just get 30 people in here and assign everybody a section, just to dust and clean and maintain. But we have an amazing volunteer base of people, you know, within the area, within driving distance. But then also we have some really great volunteers that they, you know, that fly in from Chicago and Seattle and England. I mean, from all over the world, that they come, and yes, they're going to do a tour or they want to see it, but then they're also always willing to help. So volunteering, you know, because sometimes it's like, yes, monetarily, the, you know, for memberships and contributions, for the upkeep of Rancho, we do not use any of the money, donations that come into Rancho to buy stuff ever. It is solely for the upkeep, and the maintenance and utilities, just to keep it open. So, but volunteering your time is another, just, you know, you can't put a price tag on that of somebody willing to come in and get dirty and work hard, and we have so much fun. In fact, we're having a volunteer appreciation party tomorrow at Rancho, and we have about 65 people coming from all over to, you know, celebrate the Guinness World Record that we just achieved, and, you know, to just enjoy each other's company and be able to sit back, relax, and enjoy Rancho without moving any boxes. Although we do have things that need to be done. So I told Anne, I was like, I'm sure after we get a couple beers and everybody, we can still get everybody to move stuff.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you know what? You just tell them you got some pizza and beer, man. I'll come down there and help you move some boxes. You know what I'm saying? Hey, your arms must be huge. You must walk around with some guns if you're throwing around 20,000 pounds worth of stuff around, huh?
I mean,
you look like Hulk Hogan or what?
I am, as a child, let's see, when I was 10 years old, I started working in the melon fields in Indiana. And my sister and I both did. And we got huge guns on the arms when we were kids. And I have, so you know what? I do. I got some pretty good, because people are like, oh, Kinsetta can't move that. And I'm like, oh, I can move that. Judge me by my size, do you? I'm like, I got this. So I actually have some really good upper body strength.
Awesome. Hey, I'll just have to finish it up, Kinsetta, and by saying that, you know, in that clip, Steve said that this wouldn't be possible without the help of not, you know, people like you and even other collectors, because I did hear him say it was somewhere, another podcast, but I can't remember what it was, but he did say that, you know, sometimes he just gets stuff from maybe, like, let's say a Gus Duncan and vice versa, and they just do it just because they know each other's collections, and they just kind of do it. They don't ask, do I owe you money, do I, just boom, here's something that I found that you don't have, mm-hmm. here you go. And he said it right there, you know, he gets help from everybody, and that's including everybody obviously at Row. And that's helped him amass this massive collection. I thought that was a really cool statement that he made on that YouTube video, that it's not just him, it's help of a lot of other people. So that was really cool.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the Star Wars community always comes together, and there is an amazing, you know, support team, support group of people out there that do that. And one of the favorite things that Steve gets as part of the collection are fan-made items. And, things come in all the time. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's awesome to see the support and people that just want to contribute to Rancho Obi-Wan. And it's for everybody to have that opportunity to see something that maybe they haven't seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, Matt, both of our podcast T-shirts are in Rancho Obi-Wan.
Yes, oh, they are.
Okay, that's what put him over the limit. That's what gave him the Guinness record. I get it.
Put him over.
I'll make sure those are cataloged and they're in the inventory.
Oh, there you go. Oh man, it's been fun. Consetta, thank you for taking a few minutes and letting us know. I mean, a wonderful honor for Steve, and I can't wait to get down there. I think we're looking around April, right, Chris? To try to get down there.
Yes. I had to push it back because, like, nobody. Well, I hadn't mentioned it on the show, but I'm in the midst of in between jobs right this second, so it's kind of like crap, bad timing for that, but whatever. So I'm looking towards, you know, April, early in the year, because I know the holidays are going to be crazy. So
cool.
So you guys will have to let me know when you're coming.
Definitely, we will.
Oh, definitely. I'd love to for you to be there at the time. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We got some plans. We got some plans in the works. You know, we want to do our second video podcast from Rancho Obi-Wan. So we will definitely be in touch. Consetta, I know you're so busy right now. You probably got to go unload some boxes or something like that. So we got to let you go. People can also hear you on the Full of Sith podcast, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Along with Brian Young and Mike Pilot. Yeah.
Definitely. Full of Sith. Full Sith, yes. We've had Brian on the show a couple of times. Love talking to Brian. And James is doing fantastic, as always. I know you're working with him.
Yes, and James Arnold Taylor is, he is fantastic.
Right, yeah. So, you know, continued success with everything going on. And we will talk to you soon, hopefully, if not in person at Rancho Obi-Wan.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Have a great weekend, guys.
Okay, thanks a lot. We'll see you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, there you go, Chris. You know what to do. I'm looking at you, man. You're the one that's going to take over this Guinness Book of World Records in 2015, right?
Yeah.
Go for it.
I'll count each Lego brick as an item.
Hey, wow, that was cool. It was great to have Consetta on. So we do have some other things to talk about, though. We got some news and notes, and we're going to get to our underrated contributors to the Star Wars saga in just a minute. So let's see what's going on in the news and notes section.
Hello there. You're listening to the Sarlacc Pit podcast, an elegant podcast for a more civilized age. You can go about your business. Move along.
All right. So starting off, Chris, a couple of things I wanted to get to. Let's start with J.J. Abrams. And I just saw Star Trek Into Darkness. I know you've just seen it too, and this is the last thing that Abrams has done now that he's moved on to Star Wars Episode 7. So as I'm watching this, I'm kind of looking at it with, you know, not a critical eye, but I'm kind of looking at how it's done and what I like about it. And
spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it yet, skip ahead.
Yeah, no. Well, let's see. It just came out on video, so. But yeah, I don't know. It's, here's the thing. Let me take you to the beginning of the movie. Let me just say it. I liked the movie, and there were some good things that I liked. And I'm looking at it. You know, the first thing I noticed was, in the beginning, there's a shot of. The Enterprise, coming out of the water, and to where these. Alien people see it or whatever, but I just love the way that it looked coming out of the water. And what I mean by that is it looked like a real ship. I mean, just the I wish I could find a better way to describe it, but it didn't look like a CGI effect. Yeah, you know what I mean? It looked like a real set piece. And that's practical. I guess that's what I'm looking at. It looked like a practical effect. And that was cool. And just the whole film was, it looked really good, right? It looked fantastic. And so I think that some people may not put much weight into Star Wars Episode 7 on 35 millimeter film. And I can understand that, you know, especially nowadays. But still, I think that makes just a little bit of difference, especially with practical effects and CGI. I think that makes a little bit of difference. And this movie is a good example of that. That one shot of that ship coming out and the scale of it, the scale is what did it for me too. I mean, it just looked gigantic, you know. And what else? There's a couple other things. The ship blasts off into space. I kind of like that. Oh, here you go. The emotional content of the film and some of the lines and the delivery and the drama of the film really worked for me. Like, none of it did I ever wince, like, ooh, that didn't sound so good. You know what I mean? Like you did with Episode 2. None of the drama and some of the emotional stuff was corny to me. And I thought that was an important point. And again, that has to do with more of, you know, the actors and the dialogue and of course the way J.J. Abrams directs it too. So I thought that was good. But all in all, I thought it was a good movie. It wasn't like, you know, we're not talking Star Wars here. You know, this thing was missing some lightsabers. It was missing the Force. You know, it was missing all that cool stuff. So what did you think of the movie? I mean,
I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was a lot better than the first one. Of course, you know, with the first one, you've got all the setup and bringing in all the characters. And this one, you get more into character development. I thought the relationship between Kirk and Spock was much better. Mm-hmm. I thought it was terribly funny in parts. Like you said, I remember sitting there watching that ship come out of the water, and I remember looking at it thinking, man, that looks so real. The water falling off of it, everything, it just looked fantastic. We kind of discussed this a little bit before we started, but the one thing that made me nervous, everybody always talks about the lens flares, and yeah, there's, you know, stuff here and there. Right. But the jump into warp, they showed that probably at least three times where mm-hmm. the ship takes off and leaves the trail. Well, as we know, that George has said before that, like, seeing the Millennium Falcon go into hyperspace through the cockpit is only one time per movie. You only see that particular shot once in a movie because he doesn't want it to be overdone. The rest of it you see it different ways. Now, they did in this movie, did each one of them a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But to jump into warp and see the trail every single time,
right,
it's like, okay, that's not going to work for Star Wars, but it works for Star Trek. I thought James did J.J. did mm-hmm. an awesome job. And I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. I've sat and watched it twice the last 2 days. Because I just got it. I didn't go see it in the theater this particular time, but sit down and enjoying it on the big, huge screen at my cousin's house, or just relaxing and watching this on a big screen was really, really good.
Yeah.
And, you know, what can I
say? Yeah, I know. It's not like a movie like I've watched it a couple times and it was, you know, I had a good time with that. I'm a Star Trek fan. I like Star Trek, but like I said, it was just like, you know, when, and this is, again, another spoiler. When Spock is fighting Khan, you know, he's just like, man, he just needs to whip out a lightsaber and they need to start going to town. You know what I mean? And I'm so excited for that. And especially since JJ, this is, you know, he's a Star Wars fan. You know, everybody says he brought Star Wars into Star Trek. And I don't know if Star Trek fans are offended by that. But, you know, that's what he's. What he said to have done is brought Star Wars to Star Trek.
Yeah.
And so it looks like he's not even doing Star Trek 3 now, so he's going to be focusing on Star Wars. Yeah. So I'm really excited to see what he does.
One other thing that I really enjoyed is when they mentioned the Klingons early, I was like, okay, I want to see what they look like. See how he does them in this version of it. And mm-hmm. I thought he did fantastic. I thought they looked great. You know, in the old movies, it was all makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these, we don't know if they're all makeup or what, but I thought they looked fantastic. They look very similar to the originals, but different in another way at the same time. So they were just, you know, really good. I really enjoyed them.
Yeah, I know. It was like I said, it was a good movie. So I'm excited to see what he does. And it's so wild to think that we're in September, like pretty much a year from the date that we found out about Star Wars, and still nothing new. So let's head on to the next news story. All right, Chris, we also got a new comic that hit over the last week or so. We have the debut of The Star Wars, and I got a chance to read it. I know you got a chance to read it as well. And wow, it's obvious that this is one of those first drafts of a movie, and I'm actually enjoying it. I mean, you talk about some different takes. The first thing is, you get introduced to General Luke Skywalker. And the first thing that jumped out at me when I was reading this and some of the art is General Luke Skywalker is George Lucas. You know what I mean? I mean that from the hair to the beard, it's Lucas. I mean, did you see that? Would that come to your mind when you're reading this?
No, but now when you mention it, I didn't really.
it's crazy. And this is only the first issue we have, so we get introduced to General Luke Skywalker. We get introduced to Leia in this first one. We get introduced to Anakin, who's actually, there's Anakin and there's Darth Vader, and mm-hmm. Darth Vader is not mechanical. He's actually just a regular human
with the bodysuit, which I thought was with no helmet. That I thought was really cool.
And then we have also Kane's Starkiller, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Starkiller, who is, I guess, the Obi-Wan Kenobi at this point. Like I said, Anakin, and what else? Oh, and Deke. They introduced Brule briefly. And again, here's some more spoilers, so if you haven't read this comic, I probably should have said that just a few seconds ago. But they also have a Deke Starkiller, and he gets killed fairly early on in this first issue. Mm-hmm. But it was cool. It was a different, it's just something different to read, and it's since we know what we finally get to go back here and to see where his mind was and what he was doing with it, evolving the story and all that. I'm enjoying it, and this is an 8-issue miniseries done by J.W. Rinsler. So I've been having a good time with it. It's been a good first issue. And what'd you think of it?
I remember reading it, and I texted you right after I read it, and I'm thinking, okay, now we've had different permutations of the script over the years. We've heard bits and pieces, it was this, and it was this, and it was this at this particular mm-hmm. time. So for me, when I first sat down and read it, it was like I was really trying to wrap my brain around the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because I was kind of like, my brain was trying to place it in the right point of what it was with Star Wars. And I mean, I remember George Lucas had said at one point there was the good father and the bad father, and then he merged them together to make Darth Vader. And like you said, we see Darth Vader, but he has no helmet. He's a normal guy. Right. And then when you get the Skywalker character sitting down with the Starkiller character, it's like, okay, those are two characters to me that he eventually merged into Luke, but Luke's one of the characters was all mechanical.
Right.
He was pretty much like Vader, and I was like, okay. Then he had his son Anakin, and then we saw Leia, and I was just like, oh man, it was so cool and so different, and I could definitely say that I don't think if this is the story that he went with, it would have been near the phenomenon that it ended up being.
Right, yeah.
Because that, to me, was this kind of story with all these characters a little more complex than what he brought it back down to. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Force is different in this, and I'm assuming we'll get more of that as it goes along. Right. But I'm really excited. I think it's just really cool. I mean, like you said, an 8-issue miniseries, that would be really cool to kind of see where it goes.
Yeah, I know. It's been good, like I said. And if you haven't picked it up yet, I think you'll enjoy it. I mean, yeah, it's not Star Wars like we finally get to see, but it's kind of fun to go back and look at what he kind of envisioned in the beginning. It's a nice little treat for us Star Wars fans, you know.
Yep, and we haven't seen Han yet.
So have you heard, like, there's been a lot of rumors going around, Chris, of course. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these casting rumors, Benedict Cumberbatch, and here's another thing about the J.J. Abrams thing. Cumberbatch in Star Trek, I enjoyed his performance, and seeing him come to the Star Wars universe, I'd love it. I thought he did a fantastic job. I love his take. I love his voice, and I enjoyed his performance. What'd you think?
I really enjoyed it. I think he would become he could be a really good villain.
Yeah, and some of the other rumors, of course, is Cumberbatch. Like I said, there's been, Alex Pettifer, who was in, the only thing I know him from is, I guess he was in Magic Mike. And there was another casting rumor about somebody named Solo. Like, that's her name. Her last name is Solo. I mean, come on. You got to have her in the movie. I think it was Senia Solo or something like that. She either read for a part or she's, I was like, come on. Who else has been in this thing? I mean, there's been, you name it. I mean, it seems like everybody's reading for it or trying to get on it. So, of course, it's episode 7. Everybody wants their people to be in this huge, huge undertaking. And then we have that rumor of the title. Did you hear that rumor of the title, A New Dawn? That was another one?
No, I didn't. But actually, that sounds like it could fit.
When you talk about titles, this is one of those things that Star Wars fans tend to kind of go crazy about. I mean, when that title came out and the rumor came out about the title, I mean, it was split almost half. People were saying it's like lame and it's no good and blah, 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 and then some people liked it. So this is the era that we are in. I mean, every little piece of news that's going to come out about episode 7 is going to be nitpicked and scrutinized a lot. So I don't really take much into a title, whatever. I mean, look, I had the Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones. People hated those titles when they first came out. But all in all, does it really have much to do with the movie? I don't know. Not really. I don't really care what the title is.
It'll fit.
It fits. I mean, it's
I know
new
it's,
era,
whatever. Us growing up, you had Star Wars, then it was The Empire Strikes Back, and then Return of the Jedi. I don't know about you, but to me, it fit. Whatever. That's the name of the movie. And, of course, with the prequels, like you said, The Phantom Menace, I thought, well, that's kind of cool. And Attack of the Clones, I was like, well, that's perfect because they're bringing on the clones. And Revenge of the Sith, I thought was fantastic. But I'm just like, okay, I don't really understand why people get so bent out of shape. And, a lot of times you have to see the movie for the title to fit anyway.
Right.
So,
yeah.
A New Dawn, that actually sounds decent.
I mean, like you said, it's setting up, like you said, with the other titles. I mean, A New Hope, it was because there was a new hope in the galaxy. The Empire was striking back in the second movie. The Jedi returned in the third movie. You talk about the prequels. There was a Phantom Menace, and that ended up being Palpatine or Sidious. So, I mean, A New Dawn, it's a new era in Star Wars or in the Force or in the galaxy or whatever, New Dawn. Like I said, it's not, who cares? It's a title. Come on, relax. whatever the title is going to be, it's going to be scrutinized and attacked. So, yeah. But there was another rumor that came in that same story. And this is a rumor, like of all the rumors that are going around all the casting stuff, until we get somebody confirmed, we'll talk about that when it comes to that. And what we like about whoever is picked. But this one is one of those where you're like, God, man, this would be so cool. They said that the Falcon will make a big appearance. One-to-one size cross-section is being constructed over at Pinewood Studios, along with a power plant set and a famous cantina. Now, the Falcon thing is huge because this is a vehicle, but in a sense, it's a character in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. The hyperdrive always malfunctioning, and just the way the ship is, and the way the relationship that Han and Chewie have with the ship. This is one of those rumors, like, oh man, I'd love to see the Falcon making an appearance, and they're talking about making a scale one-to-one size, so where these people, you know, the actors are in this thing, or we get to see it, and I'm so excited about that. I mean, if there's one vehicle you want to see in there, Chris, it's got to be the Falcon, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, we were talking about Star Trek there. That's another thing. J.J. Abrams did a fantastic job of spotlighting the ship, the Enterprise, and not going overboard on it. They just, you know, he picked the right spots here and there to show a full shot with the music and everything. I thought they did a fantastic job. Yeah, I can't wait. You know we're going to see the Falcon. It would not be Star Wars without the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, that is true. Speaking of the Falcon, some more rumors that came out in the last week is that they're looking to Disney, that is. They're looking at these spin-off movies to be origin stories. And one of the proposed rumors is that Han Solo is going to be one of the proposed origin stories. And I don't know. I'm fine with origin stories. You know, it's fine. Whatever you want to do. I don't have too much of a problem with that. The only issue is, it's like, for me, and this is just me, you know, Han Solo, do I really want a Han Solo origin story? I don't know. You know, it's Harrison Ford is Han Solo, and you can't have Harrison Ford do an origin story. And it's just like, it's almost like the Indiana Jones. I mean, you can't do any more Indiana Jones without Harrison. If you can't have Harrison, then I'm, you know, let's just be done with Indiana Jones. I don't know. That's just me, you know, and to do a Han Solo origin story. I don't know.
I don't know. I would like to see the origin of how he got Chewie, how they became and did that. But you would have to have the absolute most perfect person to play it.
Right.
Plain and simple. Now, if you remember with Indiana Jones, they used River Phoenix as a young Indiana Jones.
Right.
He fit. With what they used him for, he fit. And I have a different take on Indiana Jones. Yes, Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones. But I would be perfectly happy if they turned Indiana Jones into like James Bond. Mm-hmm. And you had another character coming in and playing that character. If it's the perfect person to play it, then go for it. But if it's not, then don't.
Yeah,
I know everybody sputzing about passing it over to Shia LaBeouf. I don't know. No, give us another character, another person, and a young guy that can play that character. That's the only way I can see it. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, an Origins Han would be very tricky.
Yeah, it would. I mean, you'd really have to nail it on you know, some of the writing and the dialogue, because, you know, and he's a cocky dude and a smuggler and all that. Or he turns out to be. I don't know what he's like as an origin story, what that would be like. But,
well, you know, if they did an early, say, an origin story of Boba Fett or something before what we've already got, you would kind of think that probably Han or somebody along that, around that era, would show up.
Mm-hmm.
Even a Lando.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, no, and you mentioned Indiana Jones and how River Phoenix played, and I could see that, and that was only just a piece of it. It was like a flashback.
Exactly.
And it, you know, that worked. That did work for me. And have a whole movie with a new,
yeah,
you know, it's just like, you know, would it be better to do something that we haven't seen really on screen before? And that's even trickier, because then you're kind of leaving out some of the normal fans, you know, because if you do a Han Solo movie, everybody's going to go, oh, I know who Han Solo is. Even non Star Wars fans are going to be, oh yeah, Han Solo. But, you know, think of an origin story of maybe a Darth, you know, we kind of already got a Darth Plagueis book, but we haven't seen him on film. So maybe that would translate. But that's, like I said, that would only be for Star Wars fans. They would know who that is.
Right.
So the origin story is a tricky thing. I think it's you really got to hit this thing on all cylinders if you're going to really make it work. And, you know, I haven't heard anything else about who they plan on doing. You know, we heard that the spinoff films could be Boba Fett or Obi-Wan or Yoda or something like that.
Yoda.
So I don't know.
I want to see, I would love to see a Yoda, and that could easily be done.
Yeah, that could be done. Yeah. Yeah. That could, and the only thing that, with that is,
they just have to get it right.
our Star Wars fans, you know, do they want to see that? You know, because they had a lot of us had issues with them exploring Boba Fett's origin story. So,
no, I say no. Don't do
it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing.
Don't do origins. You can have maybe reveal his home planet where he grew, you know, where he grew. I mean, come on, he's got 900 years that they could do Adventures of Yoda, you know, and whatnot. Just skip the origin. Don't, because we still don't know. George Lucas has never decided where he came from or any of that stuff.
Right. And some people might want to keep it that way. How about an origin story? And see, here's another one where you get into, you know, deep Star Wars fandom, and then, you know, are you leaving out just the casual fan when you talk about, like, say someone like a Count Dooku, where, you know, we know he started in the Jedi Order, and then for some reason he fell to the dark side. You know, is that an origin story that people want to hear? I don't know. And you can do this with a lot of characters, but like I said, that origin story is really tricky, and we'll see what turns out. So that was the latest, another one of those late rumors that came out that I just wanted to mention. Again, lots of casting stuff that we've heard, and, you know, the movie title, this origin story thing. So there's been lots of stuff, but still, you know, they're talking. Chris, we're looking at January. We're just a couple months away from filming beginning, and
that's when things are really going to kick in, huh?
Still, and still nothing. And I don't know if they're holding out, if they have people cast, or if they're, you know, are they still in the casting process? I don't know. Maybe they are. Maybe they are still looking for that perfect somebody to play some of these characters. So, anything else, news or notes or anything that you can think of, Chris, that's been going on the last few weeks that you want to mention?
Yeah, actually, I do have one little small tidbit.
Okay.
Back about 6-7 weeks ago, stories started hitting the websites and saying that Disney and Star Wars, Lucasfilm or whatever, were registering domain names for a so-called Star Wars Attack Squadron. This was what the name was. Is it a video game? Is it a TV show? Is it a movie?
Right.
What is it?
Yeah.
Well, I have actually confirmation from a reliable source that this is a video game in the works.
Ah.
Now, whether or not it ever gets finished, whether or not we see it hit, you know, come out or whatever, remains to be seen. It is just in the early stages. So take that however you want to take that.
Okay.
But Star Wars Attack Squadron is a video game.
Okay. Now, is it, I guess you can't say much more than that, but are we looking at a specific consoles or computer or
I think
handheld, or?
From what I understand, it didn't say either way, but it seems more geared towards a console than a PC.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. Interesting. All right, good deal.
Some exciting news.
Star Wars gaming, people are just, man, they're so ready for that. I mean, it's been so long since we've had, you know, just that huge Star Wars game to hit where people are just so excited for something. And we'll get there. We'll get there. The wheels are in motion, as they say, and we'll get a fantastic game. Sounds like around the corner here in the next year or so, we're going to be getting some great stuff. So stay tuned for some more information on that. Last week, Chris, we debuted sort of a new segment entitled Things That Make You Go Hmm. And it's some things that that I've, throughout the years, when you see something, you just have a different take on it. And this week I wanted to talk about Darth Vader and General Tarkin in this week's Things That Make You Go All right. So, Like I said, we're talking about Tarkin and Vader, and this is not necessarily a new thing. This has been, ever since the Clone Wars, I can't even remember what season it was, when Tarkin debuted as not even a, he wasn't even an admiral. He was a general at that time, if I remember right. He appeared on the Clone Wars, the animated series. So talk started to come about, does he know who Darth Vader is in A New Hope? And for me, again, like a lot of these things that make you go home, it's just my take on it. You know, you might have a separate feeling about it. But for me, I think he does know that that Darth Vader is Anakin. And I want to take you to a quick clip here of course, Star Wars. And this is Tarkin talking to Vader about Obi-Wan. Check this out.
He is here.
Obi-Wan Kenobi? What makes you think so?
A tremor in the Force. The last time I felt it was in the presence of my old master.
Surely he must be dead by now.
Don't underestimate the Force.
The Jedi are extinct. Their fire has gone out of the universe. You, my friend, are all that's left of their religion. Yes?
We have an emergency alert in detention block AA-23.
The princess? Put all sections on alert.
Obi-Wan is here. The Force is with him.
If you're right, he must not be allowed to escape.
Escape is not his plan. I must face him alone.
All right, Chris. So as you're listening to that, and, you know, I've listened, you know, I've seen that movie 600-700 times. So here's my thing. Here's the exchange. Darth Vader says he is here. Governor Tarkin says, Obi-Wan Kenobi, what makes you think so? And he says, a tremor in the Force, the last time I felt it. And then, you know, on and on. Surely he must be dead by now. Darth Vader, don't underestimate the Force. And he says, here's another thing. Here's the key right here. The Jedi are extinct. Their fire has gone out of the universe. You, my friend, are all that's left of their religion. So, number one, Tarkin demonstrates that he is aware of recent Jedi history. He knows about the Jedi, and of course, like, he's seen them all throughout the Clone Wars. Now we know that. And two, I think he knows that Obi-Wan was Vader's master, right? That he was, you know, Tarkin has seen Obi-Wan and Anakin, and they interact, and he knows through the Clone Wars that Obi-Wan is or was his master. So for me, if Tarkin knew of Obi-Wan, is it that much of a leap to think that he would know that Anakin Skywalker was his Padawan, which would then follow that Vader was Anakin? So for me, I think that Tarkin knows that Vader was Anakin. Now, I don't know, Chris, did I convince you at all, or do you feel differently about that? Do you think no? I mean, this is just what I think. I like to tie things up, and I think, like I said, that Tarkin knows about the Jedi history. He knows, he talks about being in a religion, and it just makes me think that he knows more than what we get in A New Hope. So, yeah. What do you think?
I totally agree. When you first mentioned this, and that clip popped in my head before you ever played it.
Right.
That's that interaction there. I think is now that we see with the Clone Wars, we see that he was military, and therefore he looks on the Force as being a religion that fits with what was said. And yeah, I think he honestly thinks that he knows that Anakin, or that Vader used to be Anakin, because what little bit we got to see them show in the Clone Wars, I think they respected each other, and I think Anakin kind of leaned towards him. He kind of like with Palpatine, you know, Palpatine was like a father figure to him somewhat. And it's the same as Obi-Wan. It's just, you know, got two dads, one on this side and one here, sitting here making jabs at him. And I think Tarkin was another character that he could look up to and respect. And I think it shows even more now after seeing the Clone Wars and then seeing this little segment in between, that they had, there's something more there between them than just Vader just, you know, being on the Death Star with you know, Tarkenton running the Death Star and Vader doing the Emperor's bidding. I think there's a little more there than that right there. And I completely agree. I think, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Tarkin says surely he must be dead by now. So, like I said, he knows who Obi-Wan is, and he knows Jedi history. So he knows that there's Padawans and there's Masters and there's, you know, just regular Jedi. And so, and look at Revenge of the Sith. All of a sudden, just this new Vader just arrives. I mean, he's there. He gets made as Vader, and he shows up right next to the Emperor. Or you know, Sidious, or whatever you want to call him, he shows up right there, and there's Tarkin. You know, so Tarkin's got to be going, well, you know, who's this new dude? You know, who's the new dude in black? So I just don't think that can happen. I think that he would know. He would be in the mix of what's going on. Maybe, you know, Palpatine says, "I have a new. Here's my new apprentice. It's Vader," and I don't know. I just think there's more to it, and that he knows who he is, and he, yeah. He talks about my old friend. He says, right here, why would he say, you, my friend, are all that's left in the origin? I don't know if he's, you know, that could be just a line like, yeah, you've been my friend for the last 20 or so years. Or is it, you, my friend, you know, I've known you since the Clone Wars, mm-hmm. are all that's left of the religion. Mm-hmm. So here's another thing. Wow, this has popped in my head. He just says, you, my friend, are all that's left of their religion. So he's saying, Vader, you're the only one left of the Jedi religion. I mean, that's kind of what I take out of it right there. Just a crazy thing that popped in my head.
Plus, you know, when you mentioned that scene at the end of Revenge of the Sith, I could totally see and hear Palpatine on the bridge saying he is no longer Anakin Skywalker. He is now Darth Vader.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that would just,
behind the scenes, yeah.
Yeah, that would right there... to everybody else there and to Tarkin would be like, okay, he is no more. This is him. That's just to show that, hey, this guy just didn't show up. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, this used to be Anakin, now it's Vader. And that would change things.
Yeah.
And apparently it shows right there that, hey, that, for 20 years in between these movies, 20, 25 years that he's worked with Tarkin. And, it shows up in the comics that we've, recent comics that have come out that is showing the Purge and Vader, and Tarkin is right there with him.
Right.
A lot of it, so.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I think. You guys agree? If you do, if you don't, hey, let us know. Let us know what you think of that particular topic of Tarkin and Vader. Let us know. Go to the website, go to the Facebook page, SpeakPipe, and give us a call and let us know. So there you go. I think Tarkin knows that Vader was Anakin. And this week's Things That Make You Go, So, Chris, are you ready to head on to our main topic today?
Yeah, let's get going.
All right, here we go.
I didn't hear you give any ideas.
Don't get excited.
Your bickering is pointless.
I don't know where you get your delusion.
You will find that it is you who are mistaken.
Don't get technical with me.
All right, Chris. You know, today we wanted to tackle a topic that I've been thinking about for a long time, actually. And when you talk about Star Wars and the saga as a whole, There's certain names that always come out when you talk. I mean, you talk about, of course, George Lucas, but then you also talk about a Ralph McQuarrie always seems to come up. A Ben Burtt seems to come a lot. A John Williams is mentioned a lot when you talk about the saga. But today we wanted to focus on a few of the contributors to the saga that maybe don't get mentioned a lot. And we got some audio clips to accompany this today, and we're going to talk about some of our underrated contributors to the Star Wars saga. And I wanted to start, Chris. I know you have a couple on your list. I have a couple on my list, and we'll just kind of just no particular order on this. No particular order. We're just going to go through and highlight some of our favorite. I wanted to start off. I'll start with this first clip, Chris. And this is we're going to start actually in the prequel trilogy, and a guy that really had a lot to do with Yoda and the CGI Yoda, and this is Rob Coleman.
People have this wonderful memory of what they thought they saw in this movie, but now when we fast forward 20 years ahead, if we make him too much like the puppet, I don't think people will go for it. The audiences won't believe in it. So we're going to be dancing this line of how much articulation do we put in the face, how much articulation do we specifically put in the mouth, and then for the lip sync, what can we form and what can't we form? We have to find the balance of what Frank was able to achieve with the puppet and then what we can do with CG. But we also have to remember who he is inside him. I really want to have a sense of this character thinking. I want you guys to be thinking about what's going on. What's the subtext of the scene? What's actually going on in his head? You want to think about who he is and why he's in that scene and why is he specifically in that shot.
All right, and like I said, this is Rob Coleman. This is him talking about, Chris, he's talking about how they brought Yoda to, you know, they had the puppet in episode one, and if I remember right, Coleman was actually working on getting Yoda as a CG character in episode one. It just didn't work out as good as he wanted it to, so they had to end up going with the puppet, if I remember right. But, you know, Rob Coleman is an employee at ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, and he was actually had a character named after him, Coleman Trebo, in Star Wars Attack of the Clones, if big Star Wars fans will know that. And he actually directed a few episodes of the Clone Wars animated series. But he was the animation director of The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. And basically, he helped raise the bar on creating an acting performance out of a CGI character and to a new level of believability. He was also integral in Watto in as a CG character. And of course, Yoda. So he was also the effects supervisor in the prequel trilogy. But I just have to say that his work, what he did, and in this clip you heard him talk about how deep they go into creating a CG character. It's not just, you know, painting, drawing it on the screen. I mean, he's talking about focus. They're actually in that clip. They're actually watching The Empire Strikes Back, and they're using that as a reference. And Coleman is talking to his crew about, hey, we got to look at the lip sync and how does that, we have to make that, we have to transition that into the CG character. We have to go from the puppet to the puppet to CGI in almost a seamless way. And he has his crew think about what's going on in Yoda's head. So it's not, like I said, it's not just, here's Yoda, animate him. He actually has his group get real deep into it, you know, and think about it, look at it, study The Empire Strikes Back, and I want you guys to create that as a CGI character. And I think his work on that digital Yoda was fantastic. I mean, you talk about, that was the one thing in The Phantom Menace that everybody was like, there's so much CGI, but the Yoda was the one thing that would have been fantastic as a CGI. But we saw it come to fruition in Attack of the Clones and, of course, in Revenge of the Sith. But his work on that Yoda was huge, and a name that sometimes gets missed on some of the great stuff that came out of the prequel trilogy. Chris, Rob Coleman, you got to love that Yoda, right?
Yeah, I thought that really shows, when you go through the prequels, that the evolution of what they were able to accomplish. Because we started out with a puppet,
right.
And yeah, we all agree that the original puppet, they kind of missed the mark as far as how it looked. Then we get to Attack of the Clones. CG looked much better. Get to Revenge of the Sith, looked much better. Even we get to the point of where they got it almost perfect when they did the Star Wars in Concert. And then they go back and they updated all three of the films with this character. And then you go to the Clone Wars, and this is the very first episode, Ambush, they nailed Yoda. I mean,
right.
They nailed the look, they nailed his personality. I mean, that when I first saw that episode of Ambush, I was like, this is Empire Strikes Back Yoda right here. They nailed it. And I thought that, and they just kept getting better and better as they went on through the Clone Wars with him. And yeah, I mean, you can't not have Yoda would never have made it through where he's at now without Rob Coleman and his group of people that they just dedicated themselves to, okay, it's got to be the best that they can be. And I love how you brought that up, and he mentions that they're sitting there studying Empire, because that much of a magical, you know, that was just a perfect storm when it came to that. You know, hey, will this work? They don't know. But then, as George Lucas put it, when it finally gets up on screen, it's just magic. It's just one of those perfect storm magical things that happen. And, of course, that's what every single person that goes back to trying to do Yoda, they look to Empire to get it right.
Yeah. Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff coming out of the prequel trilogy and Rob Coleman. Chris, you had another guy on your list.
Yeah, I just have one person that I added to the list, and it's Charles Lippincott.
Industry insiders had been predicting doom for Star Wars, but a small army of fans had been building, thanks to the foresight of Lucasfilm.
Charles Lippincott was brought in as a marketing director. He was a science fiction fan. He had contacts with the fan base. That was critical, we felt. The science fiction fans were going to be the big supporter of this film, regardless of its popularity with any other audience. So that was the key target audience to start with.
Aside from licensing posters and t-shirts, there was little support outside of Lucasfilm's marketing efforts to promote Star Wars. Fortunately, Charles Lippincott was able to secure a comic book deal with Stan Lee and Marvel Comics. He also convinced Del Rey to publish a novelized version of George Lucas's screenplay in November 1976. By February the next year, 500,000 copies had completely sold out.
All right.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, you just sit there and look at what he did with the San Diego Comic Con and that little bitty con at the time.
Right.
And just him trying to get the word out. But to me, landing a deal with Marvel Comics and Stan Lee, that was a huge thing back then. I mean, absolutely huge that they would get this going into the comic series. And the fact that Stan Lee and them, they were given a lot of rein to continue the story after the movie. And then also the novelization, getting that out into bookstores and being able to have this book and to sell out 500,000 copies in 1976 to 1977, you know, that's a big deal for an unknown movie. I think the book itself probably generated more people and interest to go see the movie than the comic, obviously, because comics would be geared towards kids. And then with the fan base, getting out there with the fan base and making sure that the Comic-Con scene, that these people would, you know, talk to their friends and get it. And, of course, when the movie comes out, it just all just blew up. So, to me, Charles Lippincott is what couple of things that he did as director of marketing just really, really helped boost the movie. That obviously they didn't see any returns on that until the movie came out, and boy, did it have some returns. So,
oh yeah, I think, again, another one of those huge contributions that sometimes gets forgot about. But yeah, of course, the marketing director, and I love the fact that, you know, they knew what they who they wanted to target right off the get. They go, let's get these sci-fi fans on board. They're the target, and then, you know, the sci-fi fans will create this buzz, and then it'll blow from there. It'll go from there. And I think you're right. I think this comic deal and this novelization deal they did was huge to get to those, like you said, those San Diego Comic-Con, those fans. You know, and I remember seeing pictures and back in the day when they did that. This is when San Diego Comic-Con was just, you know, a few people that were doing some comics. It's not what it is today. And that was a huge thing. And I think as far as the marketing for this type of film back in 1977, I mean, this was the only way you were going to get this movie out there, because all the problems that had plagued it to that point, you know, especially with Lucas and all the problems that he had shooting the thing and with the crew down there. And it's just like, man, he had always been behind the gun on this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this marketing stuff is, look at marketing today. I mean, this is what sells a film, you know, with all these trailers, and they spend millions and millions of dollars on marketing.
Yep.
And 77, they had to do it through the sci-fi fans, and that was their target. And from then on, it blew up. So,
and pushing out toys and stuff. And also, a lot of people don't realize it too, though, that Marvel Comics was almost to the point of bankruptcy when they got this.
Yeah.
And Star Wars really helped get them back up to where they needed to be. So it was, to me, it was a win-win situation. They helped Marvel. Marvel helped them. They helped each other out. And both, you know, look at them now. Marvel is as strong as it's has ever been.
Yeah, and they're all under the same umbrella, which is Disney now. So they're back together. Hey, I'm going to stay in or go back to, actually, the prequel trilogy and highlight another contributor that sometimes we forget about. And that is the wonderful exploits and sword master that is Nick Gillard.
I was looking for a kind of sword fighting that was reminiscent of what was in the movies that we'd already done, but a more energized version of it, because we'd actually never seen real Jedis at work. We'd only seen, you know, old men and crippled half-droid, half-men, and young boys that had learned from these people.
I'm Nick Gillard. I'm the stunt coordinator. I got on the stunt register when I was 18. When we train actors, we would write a fight that may be a minute long, but that'll be in 5 or 6 sections of 6 or 7 moves only. So then we just go through really very slowly and then just start picking up the pace. There's no room for error in any of the fights. You won't see it because they're so fast, but if you slow them down and freeze frame them, they can only parry there or they can only attack there. But the moves are so natural or so correct, it's the only place they can be. Since they had chosen such a short range weapon, they would have to be so good if they're up against ray guns and lasers. So they would have studied every great sword fighting style and come up with a kind of mixture of kendo and samurai and every sword style there's ever been, and you know, a bit of tennis and a bit of tree chopping, everything that you could swing at.
So I just want the form of fighting and the role of the Jedi Knight to be special and more spiritual and more intellectual than just a fighter or a superhero or something like that.
So, like I said, Nick Gillard, sword master, stunt guy, he was in charge of all the fights in the prequel trilogy. And I gotta say, you know, we did a show ways back, and if you want to check it out, it was a fun show. We did our favorite lightsaber fights. I think it was our top 5. And actually, the fight in The Phantom Menace between Qui-Gon, Maul, and Kenobi was my second favorite Star Wars fight of the whole saga. And that was, of course, attributed to not only Lucas saying, hey, I want to go back to, you know, this is the Jedi in their prime. I mean, these guys are butt kickers at this point, you know, fantastic swordsmen, and he wanted to have an exciting fight, and he brought in Nick Gillard to do that. And of course, like I said, stuntman, coordinator, he's known as the Sword Master. He also had a minor role in Revenge of the Sith as Syndralic, who also made an appearance in the Clone Wars. So it's kind of cool that he got his own little character in there. But it's the audio clip. It talks about the process of how Gillard staged these high intensity fight scenes. And I also love the fact that Lucas wants his actors to do the work. You know what I mean? He wants, and the fact that he does these lightsaber and he sets up these shots to where you see these guys fighting. You see it's Obi-Wan, it's Ray Park, you know, it's Liam Neeson. They put in the time, the effort to stage these fights. And I just love that he does that. And in some of the action scenes of other movies where it's fast, super fast, you know, cuts and all that, I hate that. You know, I want to see what's going on. And Lucas does these shots where these wide shots where you see all the action going on, and there's 2 or 3 seconds, 4 or 5 seconds, whatever it is, of full on fighting. There's no quick cuts. You know, he lets you see the action and the actors are doing the work. And I just love that. And I love these fight scenes. I mean, these intense, crazy, you know, acrobatics. I love the acrobatics that he brought into it. Ray Park brought in a lot of martial arts and wushu and gymnastics to his role, and I just love that, especially that butterfly flip he does when Obi-Wan tries to slice him, and he does this horizontal roll. I think he calls it the butterfly flip. I mean, I was just like, it just blew my mind when the first time I saw that. This is unbelievable. So I got to give some props to Nick Gillard. for setting up these fantastic fights. I do have to say that the Obi-Wan Darth Vader fight at the end of Revenge of the Sith, it might be in my top five. I can't remember where I put it in my list, but I think it's one of those things that kind of you build up this fight in your head and there's nothing that's going to come up to what you imagine. So maybe it kind of suffered from that a little bit, but nonetheless, Nick Allard, fantastic work in the prequel trilogy, showing the Jedi and the Sith in their prime. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, he deserves everything that he gets because, you know, for us, the people like us that are older and got to go through and see all of the stuff coming up for the movies, you know, we're getting ready for the Phantom Menace, and we know that we're going to see more fighting. It's going to be different. We, you know, George Lucas has told us this, and so Nick has been working on it. We've seen little bits and pieces on StarWars.com about this, and so we're all excited to get to see all this stuff. And you go sit down in the movie, and it's not 5 minutes into the movie, bam, you got this big fight between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon fighting Droid Dekaz, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Of course we get more and more, and then that last fight is, like you said, three people fighting. We've never seen this, and to see all the acrobatics and the jumping around, using the force jump, force run, and stuff like this, it just opens up a whole new bunch of windows for us to see so much more than what we got in the original trilogy. And yeah, I mean, Nick just did a fantastic job through all of the films, and the way they did it, I loved how they pick it up a little bit more, a little bit more, and a little bit more as each film goes along, and loved how Ewan McGregor and Hayden Christensen worked so hard to get that last fight.
Yeah, perfect. They worked tirelessly. Yeah,
and I loved it. I loved the last fight. Yes, it was a lot to me. That's what made it so good, because it was so long. They were so equally matched that it had to be that way. And that's just how I saw it, and that's why I liked it so much. And I know your feelings on it and everything. And some other people, like my dad's mentioned, it's just so long. I'm like, yes, that's the point.
Yeah, I don't have too much of a problem with it as long as it is. I mean, this is like the fight, and they wanted to make it like, you know, this is the culmination of the whole prequel trilogy right here coming to fruition. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a problem with the length of it. I just wish they kind of would have tied some of the past in, or not the, I guess it would be the future, with, you know, the original trilogy when we saw them fight. It was more deliberate, it is slow and all that. I wish they kind of would have brought some of that into that last fight with some more dialogue in between the fight. I know there was a little bit, but
yeah.
And maybe it's just slow it down a little bit. The only time it really slowed down was when they were on the lava rocks or the floating lava things.
Yeah.
And they were kind of bickering at each other for a second. But nonetheless, I mean, just like you said, the tireless work they put into that thing. I mean, they just went for it. But like I said, it was, he did a fantastic job. And I don't know. It's just, you got to give him a props for that. I mean, he was talk about a daunting task. He was in charge of, you know, bringing Jedi and to their peak. You know, I mean, George Lucas said, "Hey, I want to show the Jedi at their peak." And it's like, okay,
that's quite,
you know,
that
no,
is,
no pressure there.
That is quite the pressure packed position, you know, going into the prequel trilogy.
So Nick Gillard is on our list as one of those guys that sometimes we forget about. I mean, he's been in the news a lot, not in a lot, but you know, he has these, like, he goes around and does these Jedi Academy type things, and I'd love to do that one time just to mess around with the Swordmaster. Chris, did you have another audio clip you wanted to play, or the rest of them are on mine?
No, you've got the rest of them.
I got the rest of them. Okay, we still agree on all these things. The next one, let's go to the original trilogy this time. And I know a couple of Chris's favorites. This is Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett.
As elaborately detailed as the sets were at Elstree Studios, equally impressive was the work done in California. ILM was able to produce special effects that were light years ahead of those seen in the first Star Wars.
If you look at Star Wars, you're either kind of in space, and they're all, and maybe the Death Star's back there, maybe it isn't. And you have a number of shots on different planets. If you look at Empire, and it's broad, you've got a speeder sequence, and two or three big dogfights. You've got the whole Cloud City and all the interiors of different landscapes that are way beyond what we've done before. So it was the breadth of the work that I think differentiates that from the first show. And each one of those sequences require different problem-solving skills.
Well, stop motion is a process where you put a puppet, an articulated puppet on a stage, and you physically, you know, move it, you know, frame for frame for frame. Yeah. And for every movement, you take a frame. And that creates, once you see it projected at 24 frames a second, the feeling of movement. However, what you don't get when you look at those images is anything other than a very clearly defined still image. GoMotion has a computerized rod that's attached to the puppet that is pre-programmed so that when the shutter of the camera is open, the character actually moves, thus creating a characteristic motion blur that you see in regular photography.
So that was Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett talking about their craft, and two guys that, I mean, when you talk about the original trilogy, wow, these guys were huge in creating some of the stuff that Lucas wanted to put on film. Let's start with Phil Tippett. Chris, movie director. He's an award-winning visual effects supervisor and producer. And he had specialized in creature design and character animation. And in 78, he was the head of ILM Animation Department. And him and John Berg, another name, for Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back, they brought about this new technology. You heard in that clip Phil Tippett talking about stop motion. And then he mentions this new thing that they actually invented called Go Motion. And they used this to animate the AT-ATs and the Tauntauns. And like he talked about, Phil Tippett talked about in that clip, is from what I can understand about the difference between stop motion and Go Motion was that the Go Motion was connected to a computer and they were able to actually incorporate a motion blur, he says blur in it, to where it makes it more realistic. You know, it has that flowness to it. And this is something that they invented. It's just so amazing to me that these guys were inventing stuff, Chris, as they were going along in a movie. I mean, how crazy. It's not like today where everything's just there. You know, you got all these computer programs and ILM to, you just take a movie there and, hey, this is what I want to do. These guys had to create stuff. I mean, these guys were creating and building computers to handle some of the stuff. And it's just like, wow. It's so impressive that they did this and inventing new technologies to make the stuff that George Lucas wanted to see on screen. So Phil Tippett, we'll start with Phil Tippett, Chris. What do you think about his contributions and this Go Motion? I mean, this is crazy technology, huh?
Yeah, for me, when you go back to there's three names, and Phil Tippett, will talk about him. He did a lot of the stop motion action. He, like you said, the AT-ATs and the Tauntauns, and then later in Return of the Jedi, he brought to life the Rancor, and I thought, oh my gosh,
he did such
a fantastic job. And Dennis Muren, at the same time, him sitting there discussing how each movie was. It's like each Star Wars had these kind of problems and problem-solving skills and solving all these things. And then Empire brought on a whole new era of problems to solve. And each movie tripled the one before as far as how many effect shots and this and that and everything else that went. So like you said, every single thing that they were doing each film was just strictly on the fly. They were learning, they were making this stuff up, they were figuring out, they were inventing new things constantly with each film and how to do these things. And they basically were just reinventing so much stuff and how to do these films. And then those same skills went on to other films. And one of the other names that I right here with this same group is John Dykstra. He did so much of the visual effects and stuff like that. I remember he also went on to do the original Battlestar Galactica TV series in the same time as he was doing this. These same guys also worked on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, other big hit movies of Spielberg and other films that were out at the same time. All these guys were working on these films because they had all because of what they had accomplished and with Star Wars. Because if you know, if they hadn't have done what they did with Star Wars, then they wouldn't have had these other jobs, and other people like Steven Spielberg wouldn't have been able to use them, you know, to use their technology and their brains. And you know, I mean, when it comes back to like two of my favorite ones has always been Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett, because anytime you see the old documentaries, they pop up. You know, that's main ones that pop up.
Right. Yeah, Muren was one of the original, you know, hired guys for ILM when they started this studio. You know, they're kind of founded this new studio. And like I said, Muren had an important voice for pioneering in all these new technologies and special effects. And, you know, I think his specialty was like the models and the miniatures. And of course, he brought it to other movies. Like you said, I mean, there was Terminator 2. I think that was the one thing he was most proud of, actually, was Terminator 2. Of course, work in Jurassic Park and stuff like that. And he's also won eight Oscars for visual effects. So suffice it to say, Muren has had a huge impact in all of movie making for some of his work in special effects. And when you talk about Star Wars, these two guys, and with the help of, like you said, Dykstra, man, they just did some unbelievable work, pioneering stuff in getting Star Wars to the screen. So got to highlight those two guys. Next up in our contributions, let's go to another guy that sometimes, you know, we think of Joe Johnson as the guy who directed Captain America, and we think a lot about his director stuff, but he was, again, one of those pioneers in Star Wars.
There were some storyboards and some concept illustrations that Joe Johnson had done. There were some paintings that Ralph McQuarrie had done.
Everything came either from my sketches or Ralph's paintings and drawings and any input that George might have, you know. There wasn't a lot of outside influences on Star Wars.
And that's a little bit from Joe Johnson and what he brought to Star Wars. And, you know, when you talk about, like I said earlier, Ralph McQuarrie is brought up as one of the guys. And sometimes we forget, you know, about Joe Johnson. And you heard in that clip, you know, he began his career as a conceptual artist and effects technician on the first Star Wars film. But, you know, he said in that clip, everything came from my or Ralph's paintings or drawings. And there was not a lot of outside influences in creating some of the Star Wars. And we heard, you know, Lucas had jotted down some quick sketches of what he thought some of these ships were, and he gave them to Ralph. And some of these he also gave to Joe Johnson. He said, hey, go with it. You know, create something out of these little sketches. And, of course, we all know what they brought to Ralph McQuarrie brought. But, Joe Johnson did do a lot of stuff, you know, and he was also responsible for the design of Boba Fett, the distinctive armor and the equipment. And everybody, you know, everybody talked about Boba Fett. I mean, he was the shit, you know, when he came out. You know, everybody was talking about him, and this was because of Joe Johnson and some of the stuff that he did with Ralph McQuarrie. And he also designed the look of many of the ships in the original trilogy. And again, another one of those kind of pioneer guys, and another one of those early ILM employees. So got to give some props to Joe Johnson. What do you think, Chris?
Yes, indeed. And, you know, when you look back on it and you see Ralph McQuarrie, he did a lot of the conceptual scenes. I mean, yes, he did characters, spaceships, and all this, but he did whole scenes and environments. Joe focused more, like you said, on characters and vehicles. He wasn't necessarily doing all the scenes, but
Right.
When you go back and you really get to go in and look, you really see how much Joe Johnson actually did. He did a heck of a lot of work on there that, like, for me growing up and even in my early 20s, I knew Ralph's contribution, but I did not know that Joe did this much work until I got older. And I was like, oh, my goodness, he did a heck of a lot. You know, I always thought of, oh, Ralph did it. But then you get to looking in it and you get all this behind the scenes stuff and you see just how much of Joe Johnston that's in a lot of these characters. And of course now we get, when they started bringing out the Hasbro, putting out the Ralph McQuarrie concept figures, and then there's the Joe Johnston concept figures to go along with it, which is just makes it complete.
Yeah, that was one of those things when they do a figure of a concept, I mean, that's pretty huge. I mean, that was like when they did all the, you know, some of the Ralph McQuarrie concept statues and stuff like that. I mean, that's an ultimate tribute right there, where something that that didn't even make it to the film is brought out as a whether it's a 3¾ or it's a statue or 12-inch or whatever. I mean, wow, that's pretty ultimate stuff. And like you said, they brought out that white Boba Fett, and it's like, wow, that's a great tribute right there. And I think it was Joe Johnson that actually got into the suit at one point just to try it out, Chris, or something like that, or try it on, if I remember right. But, yeah, definitely Joe Johnson. You know, we always talk about Ralph McQuarrie and, of course, his massive influence on Star Wars. But there's also Joe Johnson, too, that brought a lot to the table, especially in the world of the artistry and some of the characters and the vehicles, like we said. Chris, let's stay in some of the early days of the original trilogy and talk about Gary Kurtz.
The making of Empire was a whole set of problems that we didn't anticipate. The picture was much bigger undertaking than originally conceived. The budget was quite a bit more. Everybody who's dealt with visual effects said, never do snow because you can't maintain the color. We ignored all of those warnings and decided to shoot in the snow anyway. But it was a very time-consuming process. And again, just like in Tunisia, we were in Norway shooting on this glacier, and we had the worst winter in Scandinavia than they'd had in 50 years. 20 below zero, 18 feet of snow. We shot several scenes in Empire over again. There's a scene in Cloud City where Han Solo character is kind of pacing up and down, and Princess Leia comes in, and he reacts to the way she looks because she's dressed differently than she has in the entire rest of the film.
And Slade.
So we shot it in a slightly more subtle fashion, which is the way it's in the film now.
I don't trust Lando.
Well, I don't trust him either. He is my friend.
So we're talking about Gary Kurtz, Chris. Of course, he producer for the first two installments of the original trilogy, Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. And this is one of those kind of controversial ones because Kurtz and Lucas butted heads a little bit from what I've read and what I've heard. But all in all, though, his contribution, you know, a lot of people, when you talk about Star Wars and the saga as a whole, and I'm just saying a lot of people, you know, think that the first two were the two best films in the whole saga. You know, it's a lot of people say maybe Star Wars, The Empire, and then it goes from there. And it's it's a little bit of a surprise that Kurtz was the producer on the first two. And if memory serves, he wasn't on the producer for Return of the Jedi. He kind of jumped out after Empire. And there was some conflict between these two. And when you talk about producers, you know, some people, you have Gary Kurtz, and then a lot of people talk about the prequel trilogy and Rick McCallum and how he was, it's going to sound bad, but a lot of people say he was a yes man. Whereas Gary Kurtz was maybe on the other side. He fought for some things in Star Wars and The Empire. And like I said, there was some clash between him and Lucas. But all in all, when you talk about the influence that Kurtz had, he talks about it in this clip here. There was some stuff, daunting stuff. They said never shoot in snow. Kurtz and Lucas said, no, let's do it. I mean, you know, this is Hoth. I mean, what are we going to do? We have to do this. We have to make this work. And they had some interesting ways about making it work, how they shot in the hotel, was it the lobby or something like that? And they shot actually out into the snow. It snowed yes. so much that they were able to do that. He talks about some of the scenes between Han and Leia, and they just weren't working right. And they had to switch things up, switch up the dialogue and to make it flow and to make it come out like the way it did, like so natural, and we've all believed it. So Kurtz had a big influence of the first two, and he bowed out in Return of the Jedi. And I don't know, what do you think, Chris? Gary Kurtz had a big influence in those first two movies.
Yeah, because he, you know, he's like he's, you mentioned the other guy that did the prequels.
McCallum?
Yeah, McCallum. He, like you said, he was a yes man, but he's just like, okay, he knew that this was George's vision, and whatever he wanted, he was going to get. Now, Gary Kurtz, he didn't feel that way when it came to Return of the Jedi. And,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to see some things differently, but, you know, that's his prerogative. That's his point right. of view. And, you know, I think it's great that he, you know, stood up for what he wanted. But, yeah, I mean, he did a fantastic job with Star Wars and Empire and helping to get everything going and keeping things going with as much trouble as they had with these films. And it's, you know, they go to Tatooine, to Tunisia to do Tatooine, and it, you know, they have all these sandstorms and these huge rainstorms that hasn't happened in 50 years there. Then they go to Empire, and then they go to Norway to do the Hoth, and then they have the biggest storm, you know, that area has ever seen in like 50 or 100 years. So, you know, you get all these monumental tasks that they had to work through and get past, and you know, it's just like, it's amazing that any of these movies got finished. So
yeah,
you know, and he was a huge part of that, you know.
He was
like second hand to George with all of that right there. So yeah, he was a huge contributor,
and he was these guys, like I said earlier, where McCallum kind of let Lucas do whatever he wanted. Kurtz himself claimed that he and George clashed over how to progress the Star Wars series, and that's when he bowed out of Return of the Jedi, because he was displeased with some of the decisions to, I think it was resurrect the Death Star and change the plot outcome, because I think he was also one of those guys that wanted to see somebody go. He wanted to see maybe Han Solo die, and thought that was a really good way to, like Kazan said, it kind of give it some, Return of the Jedi, some actual, like, whoa, are these characters going to make it out, you know? And that's when Kurtz said, you know what, we're not seeing eye to eye on Return of the Jedi. I'm going to go ahead and step away. And that was the last we saw from Kurtz. And it's interesting to see what would have happened if Kurtz was there for Return of the Jedi. If he was, it doesn't sound like he was going to be able to convince George to make the ending a little more perilous, maybe, than it turned out to be. So
yeah, you know, it's like Lawrence Kasdan said when he was talking about that, he felt like that some one of the characters should go as well, and he said, but you know,
yeah,
George knew what he wanted, and he got what he wanted.
And he got what he wanted, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're his
exactly.
Films. Yeah, they're
yeah,
his
and films. Maybe that's some of the stuff that happened to McCollum in the prequel trilogy. He's like, this is what he wants. He's going to get it. No one's going to tell me otherwise, and that's just the way it is. And it's his stuff, it's his movie, and that's what he wants to do. So but no, Gary Kurtz, another one of those guys, big guys in the beginning of the saga. Let's jump back to the prequel trilogy. And when you talk about the prequel trilogy, it's, you know, this was something that Lucas said, it was back in the day where things were shiny and new, and this guy Doug Chang was responsible for creating this new environment.
The design task for episode one was literally like designing five or six or seven films, in that each world needed its own history and everything needed to be thought out. So like on Naboo, we have a very craftsman and sort of elegant look, whereas on Coruscant, we have a very angular and sort of concrete and metal look. Everything about these worlds needs to be distinct enough so that when George is intercutting between these different environments in the story, you know right away where you are visually, whether it's the texture of the material, the color of the material, or the look of the material. one of our biggest challenges was to create a world that was very different, but yet still had very strong ties with the original Star Wars. And it was a very difficult problem in that we are exposed to so much in terms of movie designs nowadays that in order to come back and try to come up with something fresh is a very daunting task.
So that's Doug Chang. He's talking about what he had to do, and he said it was daunting. I mean, he was talking about, you know, he had to create all this. I mean, it just start fresh. And you know, he joined Industrial Light and Magic as a creative director, and he was in charge of episode 1 and 2. I mean, he was the design director for episode 1 and 2. So again, one of those daunting tasks where Lucas comes to you and says, hey, start designing the prequel trilogy. Here you go. This is what it's about. Here's the plot. This is what I'm looking at. And you know, he helped shape the new look of Star Wars in a pre-Empire universe. I mean, he was in charge of it. And, you know, a lot of people kind of, you know, when you see the prequel trilogy, it's just so different. But he did. He brought across this new, it was a new feeling, you know. And like Lucas said, it was a new, not new, but we're going back in time here. So I wanted everything to look fresh and new and shiny, and the designs were all rounded and really flowed. And this is all from Doug Chang. You know, this is what he had to accomplish. And again, like I said, a daunting task. But I love the look of the prequel trilogy. It looked fantastic. I mean, yeah, you know, the Naboo Starfighter wasn't my favorite design, but some of the stuff that he did, it was great. It was fantastic. I mean, the look of it, I thought it looked fantastic. So this was all Doug Chang's doing, and what a daunting task it was. What did you think of the design of the prequel trilogy, Chris?
Yeah, you know, they wanted Ralph McQuarrie, obviously, to come back and work with these three films. But with his failing health and those issues, he just couldn't do it. And so what they ended up doing was having Doug Chang, he got to talk and work with McQuarrie quite a bit to get his feelings and everything on how to move forward or whatever, and then he takes over and does everything from himself and everybody else that he's got working there with him. But yeah, I mean, he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He did a fantastic job. Everything's supposed to be more higher class, more
right,
look
yeah.
newer, and he did. He did a fantastic job. And yeah, I've said it before, I'm not crazy about the Naboo fighters, but they were cool looking. You know, I'm just like, I've seen better, you know, type things. But there's so many great vehicles and ships and creatures and everything throughout the prequel trilogy. And, I mean, he just stepped it up and did a fantastic job. And, I mean, it's nothing like how we feel about McQuarrie in the original because of our age and what we grew up with. But he's right there with them. I mean, you can't say conceptual art without being Ralph McQuarrie and Doug Chang,
right?
Because they are the two that did the majority of the work. So
yeah, and you're talking about a pre Empire universe. So and they wanted a distinct look. I mean, you got to separate the two trilogies, and you had the OT, which was post Empire, and you know, everything is all dingy, and you see the effects that the Empire's had on the galaxy as a whole. But then you go to the prequel trilogy and it's fresh, and like you said, it's shiny, everything's new and everything's neat and clean, and this is pre-Empire, you know. So that look was definitely, it worked, and his contributions to the Star Wars and the prequel trilogy, one of those things that we'll never forget here at the Starlit Pit podcast. So good stuff from Doug Chang, and he's back, folks. Doug Chang is back doing some designs for episode 7. So whatever you feel about the prequel trilogy, somebody liked what he did, because he's back for episode 7 to do some design work. So I'm just excited to see what he does for episode 7. Let's go back to the original trilogy, and we'll finish it up, Chris, with one of the guys that sometimes when you think about if Star Wars was ever going to be made, because it was close to not being made, if it wasn't for this guy, none of these other guys would have been possible. And I'm talking about Alan Ladd Jr.
Undaunted, Lucas presented Star Wars to Alan Ladd Jr., the new head of creative affairs at 20th Century Fox. Ladd, a former producer, was able to recognize potential in the filmmaker, if not necessarily the film.
We had a meeting, and George said, well, I've been thinking about this thing called Star Wars, and told me about it. And I said, that sounds terrific. I mean, the technology part of the whole thing was completely over my head, but I just believed in him and his genius. I sort of recognized off of American Graffiti that he really was a genius, so I just flew with it.
He understood what talent was. He respected talent, and he was able to say, I think this guy's talented. I think we're going to invest in him. So Alan Ladd Jr. invested in me. He did not invest in the movie, and it paid off.
And there you go. I mean, here's George Lucas talking about Alan Ladd. And this, it was a cool thing for Lucas to say that, because Alan Ladd Jr., he's famous for giving George Lucas the go-ahead to make Star Wars. And he kind of remained Lucas's only support at times when the board of directors at 20th Century, they wanted to shut this thing down. I mean, they had no idea what he was doing. I mean, like, what is this? And it was Alan Ladd Jr. that stepped up and fought for Lucas. And that clip is from, of course, one of the best documentaries out there, Empire of Dreams. Fantastic documentary. And you heard it right there. I mean, you heard Alan Ladd. He talked about, he recognized the potential in the filmmaker. And Lucas said he didn't know, he didn't really know what the heck the Star Wars was. You know, he's like, well, what? I don't know what this is, but I recognize the talent in you. I saw what you did with American Graffiti, and I know you're a talented filmmaker. I'm going to go to bat for you. And you're right. It's like I said, you heard it right there. Like I just said, you know, he didn't know what Star Wars was. What is this? Yeah, maybe he didn't even like it. I don't know. But he recognized that this guy is special, and I'm going to invest in him. And I'm going to go to the board of directors and go, hey, you need to do this, because this guy is one in a million. So when you talk about Star Wars and Chris and it being made, if it wasn't for Ladd going to bat for Lucas, who knows? This might have never happened. So
it's, yeah, exactly.
Huge influence.
You know, he got 20th Century Fox to go for it before American Graffiti ever came out. And
yeah.
To go for the idea, and then once the movie came out and it was a big hit, you would think that would be like, oh, okay, fine. There would be any issues. But no, as it went on and on, I mean, Alan said that the story and everything was over his head. He didn't get it, but he said he believed in Lucas. And he said nobody at 20th Century Fox understood it, and the longer they kept getting behind and this, that, and the other. And it got to the point where Alan quit. He flat out quit before the movie was ever finished. And
that's right, yeah.
And as it says in the documentary, that was a heavy price, because when it was time for Raiders of the Lost Ark, they went to Paramount instead of 20th Century Fox. So look at all that money that 20th Century Fox lost, you know, because of those movies. But, I mean, yeah, you get – the bottom line is he's the first person that believed in him and went to bat for him. Mm-hmm. And if he had not have done that, there's no telling if it would ever got made or when it did, how it would have looked.
Right.
So
yeah, and George Lucas says in that clip too, he invested in me. And you know, it's and he also talks about Alan Ladd, he talks about how when he first saw the movie at its first public screening at a theater in San Francisco in early May of 77. He was moved to tears at seeing how everything came together against all these odds, you know, of production problems and you know, the crew over at Elstree and the UK didn't really see eye to eye, and Gil Taylor, who recently just died, and all the problems that he and Lucas kind of fought over shots and stuff like that. But he was actually moved to tears when he saw the public reaction to what happened and all the validation that he put into Lucas finally coming to a head, and to see that in May of 77, this thing called Star Wars just explode and go into the history books as one of the greatest movies of all time and spring the summer blockbuster and all that. So I just love hearing that story of Alan Ladd and how he just went to bat for Lucas, even though he didn't understand what he was doing. He understood the filmmaker and his vision and went to bat for him. So that was just one of the top ones for me. And as far as contributors to the Star Wars saga, and sometimes we forget about these guys. And I know there's a lot more in there. These are just some of the few that go down in the history books, you know, Chris. And like I said, there's got to be more. And you that are listening, you might have some of your favorites that maybe we didn't mention. But these are just a few that we thought of over the last couple of weeks. Any more, Chris, that you can think of? Or
no,
that's kind of about it, right? Yeah that we had. Yeah,
covers all the ones that have been talking about the last couple of weeks. And of course, you know, if anybody out there has somebody that they want to mention, drop us a line to SpeakPike or send us an email at podcast@galacticbinder.com. And, you know, SpeakPipe is so easy. You can get to it from our Facebook page, Sarlacc Pit Podcast, or at galacticbinder.com and go under the podcast link. And right there on that page, it'll be right there, and you just click it and record us a message, and we'll get it put on the show.
Yeah, definitely. You saw it last week. We had a couple call-ins, so we featured those, and we appreciate that. And like I said, these are just a few of our favorites, and hope you enjoyed that, our look back. And if you're a Star Wars fan, you probably knew these people, you know. And if these are more for the people who maybe casual fans, or hopefully those of you that are listening, we kind of introduced you like, oh yeah, I remember him. And oh yeah, I didn't really realize that he had so much to do with this or that. So again, if you're a Star Wars fan, you probably already knew these guys, but we just wanted to feature them in the age when we talk about Star Wars. Like I said earlier, you know, we talk about McQuarrie, we talk about, you know, Ben Burtt and John Williams, but these are some of the other guys that had a major influence on the saga as a whole. And we're looking forward to the new crew that comes around with this new sequel trilogy and what they have in store for us. So with that, that's going to end our discussion in the podcast for this time. Chris, anything else before we go? Any notifications we need to let everybody know about?
No, nothing other than our Facebook pages, Classic Star Wars, Modern Star Wars, Sarlacc Pit Podcast.
Yeah, definitely go to those. Always some good stuff coming out of that. And Classic Star Wars, always some new posts and pictures. I'm just a fan of that page myself. And I love getting all the news and the pictures and some things that I've never seen before. So with that, we will call it a podcast. So we thank you guys for joining us and making us part of your Star Wars day. For Consetta and Chris, my name is Matt. We will see you guys next time in the Sarlacc Pit. That was cool, man. It was great to have
Thank you for joining us on the Sarlacc Pit, the official podcast of GalacticBinder.com and Yodasnews.com. Star Wars, its logo, and all things in the Star Wars universe are the property of Lucasfilm Limited. All rights reserved. All original content within this podcast, unless otherwise indicated, is the intellectual property of GalacticBinder.com and Yodasnews.com.